From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Was there color? Oh, yes. And were there lights and shiny things? Check. And was there percussion? Affirmative. Ahead on Only a Game, our man in Beijing provides an eyewitness account of the opening ceremonies and previews the games of the 29th Olympiad. Also coexisting peacefully at Jimmy Pedro's House of Judo, and two Chinese characters drop by to share with us the proper pronunciation of the Olympic host city. Also ahead, the thrice golden American softball team scales Mount Olympus for the last time.
It's a huge disappointment. You know, it's kind of a slap in the face, and we've done nothing wrong to get kicked out of the Olympics. There's no reason for us to get kicked out.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In Beijing and elsewhere in China, various Olympic competitions are underway, even as I speak. Last night, television viewers in the U.S. witnessed the opening ceremonies, which were heavy on percussion and featured a great many flying people. Joining me now from Beijing to let us know whether a good time is being had by all is the Boston Globe's John Powers, who has also been Only a Games Olympics guy for as long as there's been Only a Game. Welcome back, John.
Ni hao, Bill, as they say here. Hello.
Okay, I'll try and learn these things as we go along. I'm sure lots of our listeners saw the opening ceremonies on television, but tell us a little bit about what it was like to be there.
Well, what this was, just in case you didn't know that the Chinese invented gunpowder, they dipped into their strategic reserves and fired off 30,000 fireworks. They reminded all of us that they invented movable type and a number of good things, and probably gymnastics. As a matter of fact, the highlight of the night was when Li Ning, their famous Olympic champion, was literally lifted up to the roof and ran around the circumference of the stadium, held by wires, and then lit this enormous snake of fire that just brought everyone to their feet. This was the coming out party, as Jacques Roger, the IOC president, said. They've been waiting to open this door for 100 years, and these are probably the most spectacular opening ceremonies we've ever seen.
So it sounds like we'll see your flaming arrow and raise you a flying guy.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have never seen Peter Pan open the open the games. It took 4 hours, and the biggest thing was there wasn't a drop of rain. Most people would have liked a shower. It was stifling inside the bird's nest, which was about 90,000 people, and it's mostly covered. Mm. But we were all as children, basically, watching these opening ceremonies, the special effects, the drummers, the pyrotechnics, and it was a very auspicious day, 80808, which is, are the best numbers.
Based on what they've said, the athletes seem to be very pleased with the Olympic Village. Would it be fair to describe their accommodations as unusually palatial?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Jonathan Horton, who's one of the U.S. gymnasts, said it's like a little paradise in there. As a matter of fact, Dara Torres, who was the unofficial 41-year-old mom of the swimming team, was so concerned she might have Spartan accommodations that she brought her own pillow and sheets. And she saw that basically the place was decked out like a Marriott, so she tossed him in the closet. But everyone is delighted, and the big concern is the athletes will eat so much of the food that they won't make weight. As a matter of fact, Gary Russell, one of the U.S. boxers, did not make weight, and the U.S. won't have anybody at that weight class.
Though the games have just begun, there have already been some important results, especially for fans of the U.S. soccer teams. Can the women's team recover from the 2-0 loss to Norway to advance out of their group?
It's very difficult. I mean, they will, I think, advance out of it, but the problem is if they don't win the group, they'll play either Brazil or Germany, and those, of course, are the last two teams that knocked them out of the last two World Cups in the semifinals. It was a shocking defeat. I mean, no one expected the U.S. would fall behind 2-0 after the first 4 minutes. And, of course, the irony is that the U.S. women's team was the first team here. They arrived on July 24th. They did some touring, and they went up the coast of the LOC, and they may never be back to Beijing.
Meanwhile, the U.S. men's team, thanks to a win over Japan and the 0-0 tie to which Nigeria and the Netherlands played, is atop their group. How long does that circumstance last?
Well, no one thought that would happen, but I think it's a very tough group. They've got the Dutch, who are the European champions. They've got the Nigerians still coming up, and, of course, This is the first time the U.S. men have been there since the year 2000. They failed to qualify last time. But, yeah, I mean, everyone thought that the U.S. women would win their first game and the U.S. men might lose theirs.
Fans of badminton, fencing, and shooting got heaping helpings of those sports yesterday, but today marks the beginning of the swimming competition. What are today's most exciting events, John?
Well, the thing is now, of course, the preliminaries are at night, and the finals are in the morning, and the big story right off the bat will be Michael Phelps. He's going for his first gold medal in the 400 individual medley. He should win that, but of course, what happened at Athens is his quest for eight ended on the second day with the 400-meter freestyle relay. That's the issue again today. So everyone figures Michael will get one. The question is, will he get the second?
Tomorrow morning, the U.S. men's basketball team will face China. On Monday, the American women will also go up against the host squad. I don't imagine those games will attract much attention, will they?
Well, it is astounding here. Basically, if you are under 35 and you live in China, basketball is your big sport. As a matter of fact, they think Houston is paradise because Yao Ming, who carried the flag in the opening ceremonies, plays there. Most of the Chinese players don't think they have much of a chance, but if they ever beat the U.S. in the opener, it will make the Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid seem pale. And the U.S. men know that that is a very big game. They just can't lose it, and I think the same goes for the U.S. women.
There has, of course, been a great deal of discussion about the politics associated with these games. To what extent are issues such as human rights, China's positions regarding Tibet and Darfur, and the freedom of the press evident day to day in Beijing?
Well, I think everyone has been talking about them. As a matter of fact, something as simple as the U.S. naming Lopez Lemong as their flag bearer was thought to be a jab at China. He was one of the lost boys of Sudan, and of course that's one of the big issues here. But the IOC has been very sensitive about it. As a matter of fact, Jack Rogge at his press conference said that you can say whatever you want as long as it's not in an accredited area. So if you're on a medal stand, if you're an event, if you're in the village, you better keep your mouth shut. They don't want any propaganda, as they say, or any demonstration.
The Summer Games are comprised of so many events, John, but here's a challenge. Can you give us a quick synopsis of the competitions that you are most eagerly looking forward to seeing over the next couple of weeks?
I think the one that's really going to be the most interesting, and it's actually one of the few sports where the U.S. and Chinese go head-to-head, is the women's gymnastics. The U.S. women are the top team in the world. It's a very interesting team. It is quite mature. You've got Shawn Johnson, who's the world champion, going in. And, of course, the big controversy about the Chinese girls, literally. They think that half the team is not old enough. They aren't 16 to be able to compete here. So that is the biggest thing everybody is really looking forward to seeing here.
Well, as the Chinese government controls the passports, my guess is that those girls will turn out to be old enough, at least officially.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we were talking to the U.S. women about it, and they said, we go up against anybody who lines up overage or underage.
John Powers has been covering the Olympics for the Boston Globe for many years, and he spoke to me from Beijing. John, thanks very much.
Bill, thank you.
Beijing is expecting about 500,000 visitors to the city during the Summer Games. In the days leading up to the 2008 Olympics, reporter Ann Donahue captured some of the sights and sounds of Beijing, and she shares them with us now.
Operation Beijing, the final push to convert China's third world capital into a world-class cosmopolitan city, is nearing completion. And if you walk along the main streets where the five-star hotels and Western food establishments are, you will likely be impressed. Migrant workers have spent months repairing sidewalks and planting trees and flowers. Well, actually, planting may be an exaggeration. They're placing the flowers still in their pots in colorful displays all up and down Chang'an Boulevard, the main east-west road where Tiananmen Square and the Forbidden City are located. But if you veer off the main drag, you'll find some pretty dilapidated buildings with no indoor plumbing and no flowers in sight. And the once omnipresent migrants, the deeply tanned, dust-covered workers who have built the new Beijing, have been told to leave the city during the games. For months, Chinese authorities have been rounding up dissidents. There are now checkpoints at all the main roads into Beijing. Without proper ID, you can't come in. Even something as benign as trying to record construction sounds got me into trouble.
这工地不让拍。
Just want to record the bang, bang, bang. But if you do pass muster and are welcomed into the city, here's what to expect. It is hot. Although the locals say this summer is a lot cooler than normal, it has hovered in the 80s and 90s most days. And it's crowded. There are an estimated 17 million residents of Beijing and another million or two unofficial residents. Riding the subways, walking along the sidewalk, and negotiating the markets are all contact sports. Shoving, cutting in line, and pushing are all perfectly acceptable. And spitting, although officially outlawed, remains one of Beijing's charms that takes a little time to get used to. Sensory overload is part of the Beijing experience. Malls just don't have Muzak. Each store blares its own boombox. And the girls with the Britney Spears headphones are hawking everything from shoes to yogurt. Solitude is in short supply. One good bit of news, authorities have limited the number of cars that can drive in the city by 50% by alternating even and odd license plates. So the usually clogged roads are now amazingly passable.
Hi, how are you? Do you need something juicy today?
Take a look, silk jacket, Chinese style.
And one of the best sports in Beijing is shopping, and there are many markets that cater to the foreign bargain hunter.
I got a Mao alarm clock that looks like it's really old, and a Venus robot that winds up. And a picture of old time ago opium den.
If you're looking for a more traditional Chinese experience, opportunities abound. The parks in the early morning are full of people doing Tai Chi, and the city is dotted with temples and imperial hangouts dating back 500 years. The ancient drum tower is located about a mile directly south of the Olympic Village. In days gone by, it was used to tell time in the city, reminding folks when to wake up, stop for lunch, and go to bed. It's probably not going to be used as a timing device for any of the Olympic events.
It's tasty.
Duck. It's good.
And of course, there is Peking duck, just one of the many culinary delights of China. It's hard not to find a good meal here. But if fried eel, boiled fungus, fish eyes, and turtle soup, with the turtle still floating on top, are not your thing, there are ample Thai, Indian, Japanese, and Western establishments to satisfy any palate. And after a long day, one of the best deals in town can be found along the sidewalks.
Massage, okay? Okay. Massage, 20. Lefty down, please.
No thanks.
Cheaper, 20. Okay.
No thanks.
Okay.
Don't worry, I didn't include this in the expense report. For Only a Game, I'm Ann Donahue in Beijing.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Hit me!
Hoping that the policeman would be his friend, Carlos Gutierrez called 911 from the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood, Florida. His complaint? A slot machine had stolen his money. One imagines the conversation going something like this. Officer, I've been robbed. Could you describe the perpetrator? Short, noisy, only had one arm. When Mr. Gutierrez failed to receive satisfaction, he apparently assumed that his mistake had been calling from the wrong place. He left the casino and placed a second 911 call with the same complaint. He was subsequently arrested. The perpetrator probably thought that was pretty funny. So get up and get down. 911 is joking your town. Get up and get down. Late 911 with the late crown. Get up and get down. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a discussion with Zhu Guoqi, the author of a new book on China and sports. But first, On July 20th, the U.S. women's softball team faced the Stratford Braquettes, a superb aggregation of top college players and accomplished veterans who were trying to win their 41st game in a row.
Coming third for Team USA, the left fielder, number two, Jessica Mendoza, left field.
It wasn't going to happen, in part because of the hitting of outfielder Jessica Mendoza, who connected for a single, a triple, and a home run to help lead the national team to a 9-0 victory. When I spoke to Mendoza after the game, I said it was a shame she hadn't also hit a double.
I know. Didn't hit for the cycle. Dang it. I just was really feeling the emotions tonight, you know, going into an Olympics. We're getting close, and that's, I think, what's starting to now go through my veins.
Jessica Mendoza and her teammates would play three more games over the next 6 days in Akron, Ohio, Salem, Virginia, and Irvine, California, all part of a six-month pre-Olympic tour, over the course of which the U.S. team won 59 times while losing once. A federal investigation of that loss, a 1-0 no-hitter to Virginia Tech on March 26th, seems inevitable. But after 6 months of exhibition games, it was no wonder that Jessica Mendoza, who also played on the national team that won a gold medal at the Athens Olympics, was ready for games that would count.
I mean, you know, you go to college and you represent your school. Well, you go to the Olympics, you represent your country. And we have seen this country firsthand from, you know, Stratford, Connecticut to Portland, Oregon to Dallas, Texas. We've been everywhere. And we've met and shook the hands of the young girls that are going to be watching us. So when you're over there, you feel that emotion of representing something so much bigger than yourself.
Since softball first became an Olympic sport at the 1996 Games in Atlanta, the U.S. has won all the gold medals. But 3 years ago, the International Olympic Committee voted to eliminate softball and baseball from the games after the Beijing Olympics. That decision explains why Jessica Mendoza is not entirely elated about the trip to Beijing.
Well, and that's the flip side of the coin. I mean, I love the sport, and I can talk for you for hours about how much this game means to me. And then the fact that it's eliminated, it breaks my heart.
Jessica Mendoza is heartbroken. Some of her teammates are more inclined toward resentment.
It's a huge disappointment. You know, it's kind of a slap in the face, and we've done nothing wrong to get kicked out of the Olympics. There's no reason for us to get kicked out.
Center fielder Laura Berg has won three gold medals with the national team, and she thinks her sport has been punished by members of the International Olympic Committee for the sins of the men's game.
I just think we got lumped in with baseball, really, with how expensive it is to have two stadiums for them and how we don't bring our professional athletes. You know, I think that's the big reason with the steroid issue and all that. We got lumped in.
According to the official explanation, Laura Berg is partly right. Officials of the International Olympic Committee have been frustrated by Major League Baseball's unwillingness to provide their stars with the opportunity to play for their countries once every 4 years. And historically, the drug testing at the Olympics has been a good deal stricter than the testing instituted by MLB. The expense of providing stadiums for baseball and softball was also a concern, but officially at least, the critical factor was IOC President Jacques Rogge's conclusion that softball, quote, lacked universal appeal. Those who disagree have pointed out that there are 126 national softball federations around the world, but it's fair to say that a relatively small number of them produce competitive teams, and that no team has competed as successfully as the one from the U.S. Asked if that's perhaps part of the reason her sport was cut from the Olympics, Jessica Mendoza bristles.
Yeah, but, I mean, you look at so many sports that have dominated as well. I mean, women's basketball has won all three gold medals as long as they've been in. No one wants to eliminate them. And I don't think the Olympics is ever about letting another team win. I think it's about playing your best, raising the bar, and having other countries meet that bar and try to raise it as well.
Stacey Neuveman, who's been catching for the U.S. team since 1999, agrees. Once the games in Beijing end, she'll be traveling to other countries to promote softball. She hopes her efforts and those of some of the other top U.S. players will demonstrate that the sport does have universal appeal and that the teams in the countries she visits will improve dramatically, though that may be an unusual point of view for an athlete to assume.
It is. I mean, it's kind of against the competitive nature of athletes. You know, normally you're keeping your secrets to yourself, but that's where you have to be, step out of yourself and say, okay, yes, we still want to win first and foremost. We're not taking our foot off the gas pedal in order to build the sport. You know, don't get me wrong, we're still there to win. But in those off times, those off-season moments, the off years, you know, the 2009s, when it's not, there's no real big international competitions going on, we take those times to go and hopefully get everybody better and help other programs improve.
That's a goal for the long run, improvement so dramatic and so widespread that no matter how IOC officials feel about baseball, they'll be pressured to bring softball back to the Olympics. For the short run, the goal of the U.S. team will be to win a fourth consecutive gold medal at the game they've dominated. They'll begin trying to accomplish that with a game against Venezuela on Tuesday. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. The Olympics always constitute a spectacle, but even by Olympic standards, the games in China carry an extraordinary amount of political and social baggage. In a new book, Olympic Dreams, Zhu Guoqi, who holds the Wen Chao-Chen Chair in History and East Asian Affairs at Kalamazoo College, explores the connection between China and sports as it has developed over the past century. Professor Zhu joins me now from NPR in Beijing. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You begin your book with the contention that sports help shape, and I'm quoting now, how a national identity is developed. When did officials in China begin to see sports in that context?
Roughly speaking, from 1895, when China was defeated by Japan. So at that moment, so many Chinese, especially elite Chinese, started to ask questions, what's wrong with China? So some of them concluded that something was wrong with Chinese civilization, also something wrong with Chinese body. So from that moment on, they start prepare themselves mentally to embrace modern Olympics. So some of them argued China need to use sports to save the nation. So from that moment on till the PRC, People's Republic of China, so they basically all follow the same argument. So even today when Beijing is hosting Olympic Games, you still can hear and read the argument about segment of Asia, then how the sport is linked to the national identity.
You also maintain that participation in sports, in this case hosting the Olympic Games, may boost the host nation's attempts at internationalization. What do the authorities in China hope to accomplish in that regard?
I think that basically for the Chinese authorities, including the Chinese people themselves, they really try to achieve a lot by hosting these games. To host Olympic Games has been a collective dream pretty much since the beginning of the 20th century. So that's one objective. Secondly, to show China is strong and competitive, not only economically, but also in the sport arena. Mm-hmm. So until this moment, the Chinese, I have argued in my book, have suffered what I call the syndrome of can-do spirit mixed with a strong sense of inferiority. So with a good opportunity to win the largest number of gold medals in these games, China could put that strong sense of inferiority away.
Do you have a sense of the expectations of the Chinese people regarding how well their athletes will do at some of these games? How well do the athletes have to perform for the public in general to feel good about it?
Since to win the gold medals means the win glory for the nation, the athlete in China has been under enormous pressure to succeed. So whoever who win the gold medals were usually treated as a national heroes. But for those who are supposed to win, but for whatever reason do not win, sometimes have to suffer both oral and sometimes even physical abuses in the past. Let's hope in this time that will not happen again.
We've been talking about expectations and how things might go in the games, in the competition, but to what extent has preparation for the Olympic Games already changed Beijing and China in general?
Yeah, I think that basically after Beijing received the honor to host the Games in 2001. It started to work enormously to in order to achieve its goals. For example, basically, Beijing tried to build the best stadiums, hire the well-known Western firms to design iconic buildings. So in order to boost the image of China as an open, prosperous, respected power. Also, actually, in late 2006, the government passed temporary regulation to allow foreign journalists free access to news. That's, of course, I think is a benefit of the Games. Even recently, I'm sure you heard about this, agreed to choose three parks in Beijing for those who would like to protest. So that's a lot of efforts, basically, to achieve its goals. Another thing, of course, basically, Beijing is not the only city to host these games. Actually, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Tianjin, and other cities actually co-host these games as well. So these cities also have been transformed because of their hosting of the games.
Some host cities historically have ended up with enormous debts after the games are over. Is that a concern for China? Because it must have been enormously expensive to prepare for these games.
Actually, not that concern for Beijing. I guess for some of us who can recall the Montreal Games in 1976, the host nation did not win one single gold medal, also sustained the terrible debt which the Canadians just paid off recently. But for the Chinese, basically the budget or the deficit has never become a problem because the whole nation is behind this game.
You write that the Olympics will provide, quote, an excellent opportunity for outsiders to see the complex reality of China. But to what extent will visitors to China be able to see everything that's going on, and to what extent will they be restricted in terms of what they can see?
To a great extent, today's China is a much freer, much open. So if they really want to know the real China, of course, they cannot stay in the big cities like Beijing and Shanghai. They have to travel to interior part of China. So generally speaking, they have access to many sources they want to, but it's really up to themselves to find out.
What's the likelihood that visitors to China will come away from Beijing saying, wow, this city really has to do something about the pollution?
The air quality has been a major concern for both the host and IOC, also the ethnic from the rest of the world. I think Beijing has tried everything and anything to improve the air quality. Personally, I have been visiting Beijing for many times. I think this time the quality here, air quality is much better.
There's been, of course, a good deal of discussion about human rights violations in advance of the games. You conclude your book by saying, quote, China needs political reforms, and an overwhelming cry for cleaner, better sports might lead to such reforms. How would that process work?
Actually, the process has already started because of world attention and scrutiny. So Beijing basically behaved very cautiously, especially try its best to improve its image. Let me give you one example. So in May of this year, the deadly earthquake took place. I think Beijing handled that disaster quite well, I think largely because of world attention or world scrutiny. It's a giant progress, actually, from the Beijing's current handling of this disaster to compare to 1976 earthquake, where, of course, the Beijing handled terribly. I think it's a major improvement, I think largely thanks to the games.
Zhu Guoqi is the author of Olympic Dreams, China and Sports, 1895 to 2008. It's published by Harvard University Press, and he spoke to me from NPR in Beijing. Professor, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. In the run-up to the Olympic Games, we here at Only a Game have had many opportunities to pronounce the name of China's capital city. After much encouragement from our listeners, I abandoned my former pronunciation of Beijing and pronounced it saying Beijing, like jingle bells. Imagine my confusion when, while tuning into HBO's Real Sports, none other than the esteemed Bryant Gumbel, knower of all things Olympics, made the following proclamation.
spelled with a J but pronounced with a Z. Beijing is rich in history but still shrouded in mystery.
A mystery indeed. Where can I turn to solve this question?
Ni hao, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Carsey.
We're the two Chinese characters.
They're the two Chinese characters.
John Weinstein and Carsey Yi join me now on the line. John and Carsey, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, first of all, what is the correct pronunciation of the city hosting the 2008 Summer Games?
That correct pronunciation is Beijing. And I think it's quite simple to get it pretty close. And I feel like the jing, as in jingle bells, is something that all English speakers should be able to manage. And it's really much closer, anyway, to the perfect pronunciation.
Okay, so we'll call it close enough for American Bumpkin. Do you have any idea why so many people have gotten it wrong for such a long time?
Well, I have actually a theory on that, and it's based a little bit on history. Since I'm a historian of China, I think I can cover that. Since we've adopted the word Beijing, I think a lot of people think that because it's a Chinese word, it should be pronounced in a foreign-sounding way. So I think a lot of people simply adopt a French-sounding je sound rather than the very simple English jing. And the irony is, while there are a few sounds that are hard for students, the jing is one of the easiest ones. So it's ironic that that's become so challenging.
On your own website, twochinesecharacters.com, you have posted a second video which teaches the official Chinese cheer of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Wait, there's an official government-approved cheer?
There certainly is.
Would you guys like to just run through that once so people can hear you doing it?
Sure. We certainly can. I think we should do it with NPR, Jiayou, which means Go NPR.
Okay.
NPR, Jiayou. NPR, Jiayou.
I can feel myself getting psyched up even as you do that. I think it's working.
Well, you know, the Chinese government does have great effectiveness with mass directives, and this is yet another step in that for us.
John Weinstein teaches the Chinese language at Simon's Rock. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Carsey Yi is a Chinese-Canadian working on a PhD in modern Chinese history at Harvard, though he's doing so from Toronto. Carsey, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
No one's team could be much tougher. Ours is stronger and it's rougher. No one's team could be much greater. Oops, we jammed the elevator. So sang the 26 cheerleaders at cheerleading camp at the University of Texas this week, except they probably didn't really sing, since being one of 26 cheerleaders stuck in the elevator at their dormitory probably wasn't all that funny, even though the dormitory is Jester Hall. In fact, some of the cheerleaders passed out. Others used their cell phones to call for help. And no, they didn't call each other either. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Home Sweet Home for a House Full of Martial Artists. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Brett Favre is a New York Jet at Thursday's.
Really?
I know. I'm sure that piece of news didn't slip by you.
Teach me to go out of town.
In any case, at Thursday's introductory press conference, Favre said that he was there to help the team win, which
Except.
Is pretty much right out of the textbook. But then he went on to say that he was out of shape and he didn't know what he was getting into. So, do you think the Packers fans will have cause to rejoice once the regular season begins?
Well, I think that the television networks will, because this makes the, you know, the AFC East an interesting place. But I'm still not getting this Green Bay thing. We got a fan from Green Bay saying this might be the death of a franchise. Now, the Green Bay Packers were a brand name in football long before, you know, the Trailer Park Spartacus showed up there. This is the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, a fellow named Starr played there for a while.
This would be like saying that if Derek Jeter, mm-hmm. you know, went for free agency and went to the Cubs, that would be the end of the Yankees.
The end of the Yankees, yeah. I'm not sure.
I don't know when the Green Bay Packer fans became such weenies.
In any case, Favre watched from the sidelines as his new team beat the Cleveland Browns 24-20 in its first preseason game. Are you a fan of these preseason games?
No, because I don't work for the National Football League and I don't make exorbitant profits off of consumer fraud. So no, I'm not a big fan of them.
Sports fans in Philadelphia have been complaining for many, many years about how long it's been since one of their teams has won a championship. Does winning in arena football count?
It probably won't, but it should, because arena football is dedicated to nothing more than it is just having fun.
Absolutely.
And this was a good fun title to win, and they won by a close 59-56.
Defensive battle by arena football
standards.
That's right.
Matt DiRazio personally accounting for 8 touchdowns. What a guy.
Far be it for me to ignore college football, so I will point out that an Ohio University offensive lineman had some luck with a number this week, didn't he?
Yes, he won $250,000, and I will almost guarantee you the NCAA will get its fat little fingers into this feel-good story sooner or later and muck it up.
There has been much speculation about which wealthy basketball team would acquire LeBron James when his current contract with the Cleveland Cavaliers expires. Until this week, clubs like CSKA Moscow and Olympiakos of Greece had not been mentioned, but I suppose they should be now.
Well, it would be less credible if Josh Childress hadn't walked away from one of the most promising young teams in the NBA to go play for Olympiakos. This is LeBron James putting his hand in the air right now and saying, anybody who wants to hire me, because I am going to be the highest paid player in the history of the universe when I'm done, you're not just bidding against your fellow NBA teams, you're bidding against the world, folks. This was the opening shot in the negotiations.
In case golf fans were wondering what Tiger Woods would be doing while recuperating from knee surgery, this week they found out he's comparing himself to Pete Sampras. Why's that?
Yeah, I mean, Pete Sampras was battling injuries towards the end of his career, won a U.S. Open, and then retired. That's what Tiger is saying, that if he can't play at what he considers his optimal level, he'll retire rather than hang on. I don't think this surprises anybody, although it is significant that he's thinking about the end of the road.
It's very young for a golfer to be thinking about the end of the road, absolutely. Former Olympic speed skater Joey Cheek, co-founder of a group of athletes calling themselves Team Darfur, had intended to be in Beijing to promote peace in Sudan, but on Wednesday his visa was revoked by Chinese authorities. Do you think Cheek really expected that he would be allowed into China?
No, but I think he's accomplishing his purpose, which is to draw attention to this cause that he's really put a lot on the line for, and God bless him. But let us not sit here and be too smug. We've been keeping scholars out of this country for the past 7 years because we don't like what they have to say. And one of the real, real damages done by the current administration is that we look a little bit stupid preaching from the moral high ground right now, even to the Chinese, who deserve to be preached to from there.
American track athlete Lopez Lemung was born in Sudan and spent 10 years in a Kenyan refugee camp. He was the U.S. flag bearer at Friday's opening ceremonies, and yet the usually outspoken Lemung sidestepped questions about Darfur in the hours leading up to the ceremony. Was Lemung's mere presence there the strongest statement he could have made?
I think so. I think that was a fine gesture on the part of the captains of the various United States Olympic teams.
The Chinese have designated several sites for protests.
Much as the President of the United States does.
Protesters won't be bothered. Were you surprised to learn that Tiananmen Square and Beijing's National Stadium were not among those sites?
This is bizarre to me. I wish American television would stop using Tiananmen Square as a set. This is a freaking grave. I mean, this is a place where a really bad thing happened. We would not tolerate, you know, French television coming to New York and using Ground Zero as a backdrop for a talk about how merry and happy New Yorkers are. You know, I know they have to tap dance, you know, the corporations that own and sponsor the American coverage of the Olympics have to tap dance around the Chinese human rights record. But my Lord, let's not use this place as a backdrop. People died there.
Which Olympic events and athletes will you be most interested in following as the games move along?
Well, I generally find them during the games and then follow them, particularly in track and field. But because of my own particular interest, I'll be watching the fencing closely. I think the United States women's saber team has a chance to win a whole bunch of medals. I will be watching possibly the last Olympics of Poznikov, the great Soviet saber fencer, who personally almost single-handedly got the Russians a medal in Athens.
We ought to at least mention the heroic attempt of men's basketball to bring the gold medal back to where it allegedly belongs, at least according to all the sports writers I read.
Well, this will be fun, though. I mean, again, they have something to play for, and by God, they do.
U.S. athletes have praised the facilities in the Olympic Village, and I assume Brazilian triple jumper Jadel Gregorio was happily surprised when he arrived at his quarters.
Yeah, they made him a special bed. He's 6'8". They made him a special bed. They fixed a shower so he could take a shower.
Put the shower thing up all the way on the ceiling.
That's
is
right.
The shower.
As he says, for the shower, it's high. For sleeping, it's big. Good for him. I'm very big on big sleeping.
And finally, Charlie, news surfaced this week that the apple that is Victoria Beckham, a.k.a. Posh Spice, has in fact fallen very far from the tree indeed. How do you suppose Mrs. Beckham felt when she learned that her great-great-great-grandfather was a close associate of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and a pioneer in the workers' movement?
She turned out to be descended from a guy named Karl Heinrich Fender, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, who worked as a painter but was a very good chum of Marx and is probably one of the few communists of that period that nobody's ever heard of.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. And if I had him here in my mansion on the hill, I'd tell him a story that would give his old heart a chill.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org.
Because we care that the world still isn't fair.
On our July 26th show, I mentioned that Only a Game was celebrating the program's 15th anniversary. Bob McPherson, who hears the show on WEPR in Greenville, South Carolina, and Mike Thomas, who listens on KWMU in St. Louis, were among those emailing us with congratulations. Mr. Thomas wrote, "There is something about hearing the theme music that tells me it's Saturday. Here's hoping for many more years ahead." I mentioned during that show that our first story back in 1993 involved former Red Sox pitcher Bill Lee, who was barnstorming with a team called the New England Gray Sox at the time, and I idly speculated that Lee was probably still pitching somewhere. B. Collins, who hears Only a Game on KSKA in Anchorage, wrote to assure me that it was true. He included an article about Lee's performance on the mound for the Alaska Gold Panners a couple of months ago. According to the account, quote, "Lee walked off the field with a cigar in his mouth, a grin on his face, and another win on his record." Bridget Madden, a WBUR listener who's also a librarian, wrote to say how much she had enjoyed Charlie Schroeder's story a couple of weeks ago about the library drill cart competition. "As I sit at the circulation desk here at the community college where I work, listening on very low volume, I find myself highly entertained," she wrote. "I'm definitely not one of your dull librarians either, so thanks for a great story breaking down oppressive stereotypes." Last week we offered up a best-of show, and one of the stories we included involved a competition between people adept at reciting the digits in the number pi. In my new introduction to that story, I referred to pi as an irrational number. Ken Yellis, who listens to the program on WRNI in Rhode Island, emailed to contend that it's not. "You could look it up," he wrote, "and you should have. And so I did, and what I found is that pi is not only an irrational number, it is a transcendental number, something Ferdinand von Lindemann proved in 1882. And then one of the producers here leaned over my shoulder and said, "What are you up to? Aren't you supposed to be writing about the U.S. women's softball team?" And so I stopped reading about numbers. Any number of you can red pencil something you've heard by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Today marks the first day of Olympic judo competition, featuring over 300 judo athletes or judokas in 14 weight classes. American Ronda Rousey is a favorite to medal in the women's 70-kilo weight division. She's one of this country's judokas who opted not to train at one of the USOC's state-of-the-art training centers in Colorado, California, and New York. She, along with some of the country's best judo players, chose a more intimate venue. Only a Game Shannon Mullen has our story.
There's a simple split-level house on a quiet street in Wakefield, Massachusetts. It looks pretty much like all the others in this suburban community north of Boston. But the locals are starting to catch on that the family living here is no ordinary one.
I had the postman walk up to me the other day, and he was like, I'm just asking. I always walk up to this house, and there's 19 different license plates out here. What is this? And I had to explain to him, you know, everyone from, you know, different parts of the country are staying here. But yeah, there's California plates, Ohio plates, Texas plates.
That's Ronda Rousey, a world-class judo player who brags she could probably beat up most people she meets. She lives here with seven other judokas who can safely say the same thing, guys and girls, ranging in age from 17 to 23.
I describe this house to people as kind of like the real world house,
except
for, you know, we get to actually go fight each other every night. So whoever's having a dispute in the house, you can really tell it at practice because those are the practice rounds that actually turn into a
fights,
you know.
A good fight.
The cast members on MTV's reality show do plenty of fighting, too. But the stakes are a lot higher for Rousey and her roommates. They're some of America's top Olympic judo medal contenders, present and future, here to train with two-time Olympic bronze winner Jimmy Pedro. He grew up in Wakefield, owns the house, and his dojo down the road is one of the U.S. judo team's four national training centers.
It's very expensive to live in Boston. And it was cost prohibitive for anybody to come here. So now for $400 a month, they've got a place to live that's within a mile from my school and from my weight training facility, and everything's right here.
Pedro says having his athletes live together is as much a matter of convenience as it is a training strategy. He pairs them off as opponents at practice, and he says they push each other to get better, whether there's harmony at home or the occasional off-mat spat.
We've tried to bring them more together as a team and stress the importance of team over self. Are they still going to fight? Sure. Do brothers and sisters fight? Yes. Husbands and wife? Yes.
On the real world, there's usually one roommate who fuels the feuds. The same goes for the judo house.
I'm the instigator.
19-year-old Bobby Lee is from Florida. He competes at the junior world level in the 73-kilo weight division.
Well, I mean, I always joke around with everybody, and sometimes people don't take it so lightly, so then they start getting in arguments, and they get in arguments with each other, and I'm standing here, like, not in the middle of it, so they get mad at me.
Tensions have been higher in the past few months in the run-up to Beijing. Three of the roommates qualified for the U.S. team, including Rousey, who competes in the heaviest women's division at 70 kilos.
The house is kind of divided into who has to lose weight and who has to gain weight.
Everyone except the resident heavyweight, that is. 22-year-old Texas native Daniel McCormick is also chasing an Olympic medal this week.
I was about 290 when I came out here, and about 320 now. It's all muscle.
It's all muscle. Not bad. All right, what's your diet like?
Oh, I probably eat at least 6,000 calories a day. I eat everything all the time.
I am the extra lightweight. It's minus 60 kilograms or 132 pounds. The lightest weight division for the men.
Beijing is the second Olympics for 23-year-old Taraji Williams Murray from the Bronx.
I'm the definition of the weight cutter. I think I'm pretty much the only one that has a very strict diet. I try my best. You know, I spend a lot of time watching the Food Network to make my dieting meals as tasty as possible.
The other roommates aren't quite as health conscious.
Okay, well, this is our freezer, actually. It just got restocked last night.
19-year-old Aaron Kunihiro from Los Angeles is training for the 2012 Olympics.
A lot of Ben & Jerry's, as you can see. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things of ice cream and sherbet. Pizza is a big favorite. The microwavable kind of pizza that you'd find in the prepared section.
Does someone come and clean the house and clean out the fridge and do all that stuff for you guys, or are you in charge?
Kind of like, who does that?
We've cleaned the fridge all
okay.
the time.
I clean the kitchen and the living room recently.
That's Miami native Hannah Carmichael, a junior judo player in the 57-kilo division.
I'm kind of the mom for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know why this has happened. I like being clean. I don't know, one day I just woke up and I got tired and I just started cleaning everything.
If Ronda Rousey has a role here, it's as the longest-running roommate. She's trained with Jimmy Pedro for 5 years, since before he set up the judo house, and she says she's more than ready to hit the mat in Beijing.
The build-up for Olympics is pretty long and, you know, exhausting one, and sometimes I just wish it was tomorrow. I feel prepared right now, so now I just feel like we're just killing time until it comes, but I would rather just, you know, go fight the match, not have to bother with the nerves in between, and then go surfing.
Rousey's first match is Wednesday. The U.S. judo team says she's favored to become the first American ever to win Olympic gold in the sport. Back at Jimmy Pedro's judo house, Rousey's roommates will be watching on their widescreen TV. For Only a Game, I'm Shannon Mullen in Wakefield, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Jim Doyle and from Joy Ma in Beijing. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about Olympic dreams, view my softball photo gallery or Shannon Mullen's judo house pictures, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from judo gold medal hopeful Ronda Rousey, who talks about her part-time job.
Yeah, I work at Home Depot, so flirt with old contractors, you know, pass the time.
Whoa to those old contractors who step out of line. And it's wham, bam, right through the power tools you go. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.